You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
I'm absolutely thrilled to have Omar Bagouti joining us today, Palestinian human rights activist and one of the co-founders of the Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions Campaign. I first heard you, I think it was about 2007, 2008, something like that, and was blown away with the strategic thinking behind the campaign. But before we get into issues about complicity and a whole range of things I want to discuss, maybe it's quite good to hear a little bit about the campaign itself, the range of actions it's involved in, just to set the scene.
Yes, thanks so much for having me in this very important festival, and thanks everyone for attending. The Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions movement was launched in 2005 by the absolute majority in Palestinian civil society, including all the major trade unions and women's organizations and engineers and doctors and so on and so forth, students and so on. It called for three basic rights that Palestinians are entitled to under international law in order to exercise our inalienable right to self-determination. One, an end to the military occupation, including the wall, the colonial settlements, and so on. Two, an end to apartheid. And three, the right of Palestinian refugees to return and to receive reparations. All of these are very well anchored in international law. The movement was inspired by the South African anti-apartheid movement and the US civil rights movement, but it's mainly rooted in a very long heritage of Palestinian nonviolent resistance. Boycotts go as far back as the 1920s against British colonialism, and then against Zionist settler colonialism in Palestine. So Palestinians have used boycotts for quite some time, and that's where we've learned this heritage of struggle, so to speak. A very important point about BDS, other than it being led by the largest coalition in Palestinian society, and the fact that it's a nonviolent movement anchored in international law, a very important point is that it's an anti-racist, inclusive movement. So the movement categorically rejects, condemns all forms of discrimination and racism, including anti-Muslim, anti-Black, anti-women, anti-Jewish, and so on and so forth. We reject all forms of racism, and we have to be morally consistent in what we do. That's on the ethical, political side. But being ethical and politically correct is not sufficient to achieve justice, freedom, equality, the rights of the Palestinian people. We have to be strategic. So we adopt the principle of strategic radicalism, what we call strategic radicalism. In a nutshell, that means reconciling the need to be ethical, principled, radical, with being strategic, goal-oriented. Because if you're not strategic and goal-oriented, you vent out, you shout, but that's not enough. You don't achieve justice. The powers that be that are the reason why Palestinians are facing a live stream genocide as we speak, not to mention apartheid, settler colonialism, and military occupation, is the complicity of states, corporations, institutions. To fight that complicity, we have to be strategic, and we have to form very large coalitions, intersectional coalitions connecting Palestinian liberation with climate justice, gender justice, racial justice, social justice, economic justice, and so on. Without making those connections, we remain in a bubble. And Palestine solidarity becomes like a small club that won't succeed. We've got to be under a very large tent, much bigger than this one, so to speak, to be very inclusive, to be effective.
Talking about that effectiveness, I wonder if you can drill down those specific actions related to the UK a little bit more.
Okay, that could take a century, but because that's how long British involvement in oppressing Palestinians goes. Pre-Balfour, going through Balfour, to allowing a settler colony to be established in Palestine through the dispossession, ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians. So British issues, as you put it, with Palestine go way back. Because of that history, and I wish it were history only, it's ongoing complicity by the British government and British institutions and British corporations in the injustices, the crimes Palestinians are being subjected to, including the genocide in Gaza, we have to talk about complicity. We have to talk about ending complicity as the absolute profound moral obligation of anyone, anywhere. Some people mistake solidarity for charity. They think solidarity means I'll take some time out of my busy schedule to join that demonstration, to write a letter, to meet with my elected council member, to push them to do the right thing. That is all great, and we need all that. But the framing has to be accurate. It is not a charitable act. It is an act of profound ethical obligation to do no harm. If you can't do anything else, do no harm. How are average people in this country doing harm? Anyone in any institution in the UK must question, is my institution, my trade union, my church, my corporation, wherever I'm working, my school, my university, are they harming Palestinians and other communities? Sudan, Congo, Myanmar, whatever the case may be. Are we involved in actual harm to other communities? Not just to the environment, but to other communities. If yes, it's my duty to do the best I can do to end the harm done. That's the ABC of solidarity. Do no harm. Ending harm done by you or in your name, in your institution. So if you're part of a university and it's invested or contracts companies that are involved with Israel's illegal occupation, apartheid, let alone genocide, you have a duty to organize to end this investment, to divest. If your institution has relations with complicit Israeli arts or academic institutions and so on, you have a duty to boycott, to cut those links. And above all, not above all, in parallel, you have a duty to pressure elected officials to end their complicity. The UK still arms Israel in the middle of genocide, provides Israel with intelligence reports in the middle of genocide, sells F-35 parts to be used by Israel in its genocide and its aggression and genocidal violence against the peoples of the region, in Lebanon, in Iran, in Syria, and elsewhere. So there's a duty to end complicity. It's not a charitable act, it's an obligation.
Thank you. You also are very specific in the organizations you target for the campaign as well, because obviously many of us will receive long lists of companies who we shouldn't be buying from and those things. Talk a little bit about that really focused strategic campaigning.
Sure. Again, under strategic radicalism, to be strategic, we've always followed criteria for selecting a target. Let's take a consumer target. It's the easiest to consider. We have four criteria. First, which is very commonsensical, the level of complicity. A more complicit company, one involved in, let's say, military ties with Israel, is obviously much more complicit than a company involved in selling flowers to illegal settlements. Both are guilty, but one of them is much guiltier. So target the more complicit company. So level of complicity, number one. Number two, cross-movement connection, intersectionality, which means if you have two companies, one involved in crimes against Palestinians only, and the other involved in injustices against many other communities, target the latter, because it allows us to build intersectional coalitions where we fight together against injustice. So, first, level of complicity. Second, intersectionality, so to speak. Third, media appeal, brand name. So if you have two companies, a very famous Microsoft, Google, Amazon, Coca-Cola, McDonald's, very famous brand, vis-a-vis XYZ that no one has heard of, both are as complicit, target the better known one, because anything you do with McDonald's, it'll be world news. The Financial Times and the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal will report on it, and we know from experience. So go after the media known name, because it allows you to reach a much broader public when it's in the mainstream media, then the public knows about it. The fourth and last criteria is potential for success. Many activists, even seasoned activists, miss that last point. If all the above apply, but you have no real chance of success, regardless how you define success, every campaign is different. But if success is harming this company's bottom line, its profits, so that it feels the pain of its complicity, of its criminality, and ends its involvement in crime, then you have to have a good chance of success. If this company is a monopoly, you can't possibly succeed. How can you boycott a monopoly? You have no other choice. So it doesn't work. So we put monopolies on a shelf until a better time comes when they have competition. Then we love, take the pleasure of taking them on. But until then, don't. It's a waste of time. Let's take a very clear monopoly or semi-monopoly, Google. Google is as guilty as it gets. Google and Amazon are involved in providing cloud services, technologies for Israel's military during genocide. And they've increased their cooperation during the genocide. But some services provided by Google are very difficult to get rid of. They're not impossible, but very get rid of. So we don't call for a full boycott of Google. We call for divestment. We call for denial of contracts and boycott whenever you can. So because when you have a potential for success, then you have a much better campaign, much more effective campaign. So those are the general criteria.
You mentioned about that really focused with a chance of success. I mean, success is a difficult word always. One of the major things with Palestine is the situation on the ground is deteriorating and continues to deteriorate. And that breeds anger, but it also breeds people to lose heart, and in losing heart, stopping campaigning. One of the things I've always loved about the BDS movement is that you acknowledge the, I'm not gonna say success or wins, but you...
The impact.
And I wonder if you could say a little bit about that, because it is so important that people focus on it.
Yes, this is a very important point. First, let me address the issue about hopelessness. I speak in many public spaces across Europe. I used to be in the US speaking quite frequently before Trump. And we always face the question, especially now during the genocide, we're losing hope. No matter what we do, it's continuing. With the US completely standing behind Israel and many European governments, including the British government, we're losing hope. We have an impact here and there, but we're not changing the fact that the genocide, it's a live stream genocide, the first live stream genocide in history. Genociders never advertise their genocide. They usually hide it, not Israel. It feels total impunity. And that makes people feel hopelessness sometimes. When I face this, I always say, Palestinians do not have the luxury of losing hope. We don't. We can't lose hope, because then we accept to be exterminated. And we can't stand by while our people are being exterminated. We've got to continue doing everything we can. And so you must end your complicity no matter what. You just cannot give up hope on the legal obligation, ethical obligation to end complicity. Now, on the issue of impact, we've learned from many South African colleagues, actually. Trade unionists were the first to work with us in 2005, 2006, just when we launched the BDS movement. And they told us, you Palestinians are too serious. Sometimes you're too grouchy. You don't celebrate much. You don't laugh much. I mean, we understand misery. Believe us, we're South African. We know. But you've got to celebrate. Whenever you have a partial victory, a win, we call it an impact, because in the middle of genocide, we even feel guilty to call it success. So we use the word impact. When you have an impact, celebrate it. It helps raise morale. It helps people keep hope alive. And it motivates people to keep going in the work they do in solidarity. So indeed, in every campaign, we've got to achieve impact. If it's not achieving impact, it's not good enough. We don't want to feel good about ourselves. We've tried, but we failed. We've tried, but we failed. If you fail too many times, you're doing something wrong. Change tactics. You've got to succeed. in the sense that if you're targeting a city council to divest from companies that are deeply, persistently involved in Israel's crimes, you've got to have a timeline for the city council to actually divest. If you keep on trying year after year, you're missing something in your tactics. You're not working well enough with the community to pressure the city council members. City council members can be ethical or unethical, but they're all political animals. They understand votes. When you show up with five committed people and say, you've got to divest, oh yeah, they'll yawn, because you're five people. If you have a petition with 5,000 people in a smaller town, they take you seriously. They know, unless they push for divestment, they're going to miss those 5,000 votes. And any politician, ethical or not, cares about the votes. We've got to show them pragmatically how they lose if they don't stand up on the right side of history. If they don't act ethically and legally, they will lose their seats. So we have to be pragmatic in that sense. If we achieve that result, that's an impact. It has to be all over the social media, even mainstream media, as biased and horrible as your so-called media is, like the BBC. I mean, genocidal. But we have to keep trying, right? We have to keep pushing the boundaries. And we have to celebrate every impact and build on it and continue. But we shouldn't celebrate in our bubble something that looks like an impact when it's not. Because that's what cults do. They share the same language, the same mindset, and they celebrate everything when it's nothing happening. Yeah, the media attacked us, so we've succeeded. Yeah, great, let's go celebrate and have some drinks. Well, the media attacked you. That's not yet success. That's giving you some access to the public, but that's not success yet. What was your goal in the campaign? Have you achieved it? Have you incrementally reached a stage towards achieving your goal? That would be an impact. That's when you should celebrate. So we should avoid this herd mentality, for lack of a better word. Herd mentality can be really dangerous when people in the same group think, oh, we've succeeded, and the public just hasn't heard. We've got to make sure it's as big as possible, as impactful as possible in the general public.
Which I think it takes me in two different directions. So I'll go with the cultural boycott first. One of the areas which has had the greatest impact is the cultural boycott. Could you say a little bit more about that and its massive importance?
Sure. The cultural boycott is one of the more difficult boycotts, in fact, because we've met so many artists. I won't mention names. Actually, I'll mention one name, Miriam Margolis of Harry Potter fame. Miriam is a wonderful actor, wonderful human, wonderful person. When we met in Ramallah, I can't remember when now, 2007, 8, 9, around that time, she said, and I think she'll be happy with me sharing that, it's not like a secret. She said, you know, everything about BDS is so great, it's morally consistent, it's wonderful, it's anti-racist, I fully support. I just can't support the cultural boycott. And I said, and why is that? And that's a rhetorical question, I know the answer. She said, because shouldn't culture, as political as it might be, shouldn't be above politics per se? As in, it connects us, right? Like music, art, it connects people across divides. I said, seriously now? I mean, neither culture, nor academia, nor anything is above politics. Everything is political. It's so you always have a political choice, what you present with your art, what you present with your poetry. When you're playing the Fifth of Beethoven, as apolitical as it gets, what does the program say? Does it have any political messaging or not? It's always a political choice. So culture is not above politics, especially when culture is complicit. And then she started listening really intently. What do you mean when culture is complicit? I say when there's art washing of apartheid, occupation, settler colonialism, that is art being used as a weapon to cover up crime, then artists have a duty to end art washing crime and injustice. That's the first duty of artists. Don't allow your art to be used to art wash, whitewash through art and culture, wrongdoing, injustices, not to mention international crimes. And she said, that's a new point to me. I'm going to sleep on it. My sleeping on it might take months, maybe a year, but I promise you I'll think about that. I think it took her months to come out and support the cultural boycott. Eventually, she started researching and learning and discussing with a lot of people, and she learned that absolutely we've got to take a stance. Today, 5,500 plus film artists, mostly from Hollywood, many A-listers, Oscar winners, support a cultural boycott of Israel. Today, thousands of writers and publishers, including the Sally Rooneys of the world, support a cultural boycott of Israel. Tens of thousands of musicians, some of the most famous, support the cultural boycott of Israel. They see that art, no matter how political it may be, has to be ethical. And therefore, it cannot be used to cover up wrongdoing and injustice and crime. So artists have a duty to act in every space, not to mention arts institutions. So the British Museum, well, let's forget that, it's too evil. Let's take something easier. Take something like any cultural organization. I'm not very familiar with UK cultural scene, but any cultural institution that says, you know, we're doing art and so on, we're not involved in any wrongdoing, we don't have relations with Israel per se, but you go to their canteen, their cafeteria, and they've contracted the Coca-Colas of the world and other companies that are deeply complicit, and they say, well, you can do that. You can pass an ethical procurement policy, what we call ethical EPP for short, which says this institution shall not contract any company persistently involved in wrongdoing, crimes, grave human rights violations anywhere in the world. So no mention of Palestine or Israel, just anywhere in the world. If an institution adopts that ethical policy, then it cannot contract Coca-Cola. It cannot contract Caterpillar to do some construction work. It has an ethical policy. So that's a duty. We have to push for ethical policy. Also, and I'll stop here, we have a policy on ethical programming and sponsorship. It was produced in cooperation with the Palestinian Performing Arts Network. And it's the same thing. It says, this cultural institution shall not platform or get sponsorship from any entity that is knowingly, persistently involved in grave violations of human rights anywhere in the world. Again, no mention of Palestine. And that is the most important incremental step towards making sure that the institution is not complicit in Palestine or anywhere else.
And for those organizations, churches, and other groups who may struggle with Palestine being named explicitly, obviously that gives them a way in and opens the door to be able to talk more about the specific things about Palestine as well.
Absolutely. I mean, if you can get the University of Manchester to adopt a policy that prevents any wrongdoing to Palestinians in particular, great, do it. But I think all of us know that's nearly impossible, not in the near future. What's not impossible is forming a very large coalition of justice groups, climate justice, racial justice, gender, every justice group on campus, and push for an ethical, intersectional policy that does not mention any quote-unquote conflict zone or any particular geography. Who can be against that? I'll give you an example. We pushed for that in Derry, in the north of Ireland, the Derry City Council. It was a unanimous vote. I presented the ethical procurement policy. Unanimous vote, minus one. The DEP, whatever it's called, the far right, crazy ones. And then one of the members of the council asked their fellow DEP member, why are you voting against an ethical policy that says Derry shall not contract any company involved in grave human rights violations anywhere? He said, I know I should be voting for it, but Sinn Féin voted for it. I'm not voting for it. So it makes it really difficult, even for your enemies, to vote against. What's there to vote against? So you're insisting that my institution shall be unethical.
I'm going to take you into that slightly before looking at the UK a bit more, because you do so much work globally as well. I wonder if you could say a little bit about that in some of the post-colonial countries, but also the real strides forward in the US as well.
Yes, BDS works in about 120, 130 countries around the world, Global South, Global North. The US being the absolute most important, for obvious reasons. It is the main reason why Israel's regime of settler colonialism, apartheid, and military occupation continues committing all the injustices and crimes against us. But we see the world as witnessing a very clear shift in power from the colonial West, still colonial, to others, East, a bit South. There's a shift. And with this shift of power comes a lot of nervousness. The rise of the far right and the fascists across the Western world are symptoms of that nervousness. White people can get nervous very easily. Anyway, let's put that aside. So we work in many of those countries, again, for the same thing. Not just for their votes at the United Nations, but also for doing the right thing in their own countries. So just being in the Global South does not mean you're not complicit. Many Global South countries have military trade with Israel. They may not be selling much, except India, Vietnam sell a lot of weapons to Israel, but other countries buy a lot of Israeli weapons. Well, guess what you're doing? You're buying field-tested weapons, tested on us, human guinea pigs in Palestine, tested through the genocide and the apartheid and the occupation, and you're buying it. Not only are you feeding the coffers of this regime of apartheid, you're unethical by buying weapons tested on fellow humans that way. So a big chunk of BDS work across the world is the military embargo campaign, our biggest campaign, the military embargo campaign. It's good to report that in the Arms Trade Treaty Conference, which happens regularly, we're participating as civil society. This coming round, Israel decided not to participate because we are participating. That's a win, in a way, that's impact, because they couldn't tolerate our exposure of how many countries around the world might say the right thing, but they're not doing the right thing. They're not cutting the military ties with Israel. And it's not just the UK and the US. It's many countries. Of course, the US, Germany, and the UK are the most criminal in the arms trade with Israel, the military trade with Israel, including dual-use items, technology, intelligence, and so on. But the rest of the world are involved as well. And there's other trade, not just military trade, energy trade, for example. South Africa. The state that took Israel to the ICJ, the International Court of Justice, under the Genocide Convention, still sells coal that feeds Israel's machine. Until now, it's the biggest source of coal after Colombia shut down the coal exports under the previous leftist government. South Africa became the biggest exporter of coal. So that's also a campaign that BDS coalition partners in South Africa are working to end. Plus cultural boycotts, academic boycotts, sports boycotts. I'm happy to say that the BDS movement has kicked Israel out of one international sport, cycling. Israel is out of cycling.
As a cyclist, the scenes in Spain last year were just...
Yes, that's part of
remarkable.
It. Absolutely, yeah. Yes. Yeah. And with the support of the Spanish government.
Yeah.
I mean, when the Israel lobby and the United States started pressuring the socialist government in Spain, you should not allow the BDS movement to dictate on the cycling races and so on. You should stop them. They cannot peacefully disrupt the race and so on. The Minister of Sports in Spain said they're nonviolently disrupting a race because a state committing crimes is participating. They have every right to. I wish we had more of those ministers here.
Thank you. Bring us to the ministers here. and we do need to talk about the ministers here. Andy Burnham, as he was coming into power, started to make apologies for Labour's stance pre the genocide. Obviously, he hasn't taken any action yet. But he's talking about banning settlement goods. Can you explain a little bit about why that's virtually impossible in practice?
Okay, let me start with something I had written in a recent op-ed in Tribune magazine on Andy Burnham. I wrote, UK Prime Minister Andy Burnham, in his tongue-in-cheek apology for Labour's position on Palestine, stated that his party under Keir Starmer didn't get it right and needs to do better. And I said, this must be the mother of all British understatements. The UK under Labour, just as under the Conservatives, has been complicit in arming, justifying, and whitewashing Israel's genocide against 2.3 million Palestinians in Gaza, its intensified ethnic cleansing of the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, its regime of apartheid and illegal occupation, and its ongoing Nakba against the entire Palestinian people. This is on top of the UK's unique responsibility for the establishment of Israel in 1948 as a settler colony through the planned destruction of the Palestinian homeland and the ethnic cleansing of most of the indigenous Palestinians. So, for Labour and for the current British government to do right, let's take it at the simplest level, forget ethics. I mean, British government and ethics, it's like Swahili to them. But let's talk about international obligations, right? I mean, international law should be a universal language, minus the Trump US. The rest of the world still recognizes international law, including supposedly the British government. The International Court of Justice in 2024 said that Israel is plausibly committing genocide, plausibly. Since then, a UN independent commission said Israel is indeed committing a genocide. The International Association of Genocide Scholars, Amnesty International, most human rights organizations, UN experts said it is committing genocide. This triggers the obligation to end all forms of direct and indirect complicity in genocide and to act to end genocide. The UK has not only not acted to end, it has continued all what I've mentioned, especially the military part. So to come now and say, we are discussing a ban on settlement goods, and I'll unpack this line because it's very tricky. Even if they do, and the lobby is raising hell as if this is Armageddon, well, this wouldn't meet the absolute minimal obligation of the United Kingdom to meet its legal obligations under international law. Not the minimum, because they have to act to stop the genocide, at least to prevent the genocide if it's still plausible. They have to act to end their complicity in Israel's illegal occupation. Why am I saying illegal occupation? Because the ICJ in July 2024, said Israel's entire presence in Gaza and the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, is illegal and must be brought to an end. All states have an obligation. The UN General Assembly afterwards voted for sanctions to end Israel's illegal occupation. If the UK would respect international law, it would have to do a lot to end its direct and indirect complicity in crimes. These are international crimes. Apartheid and genocide are not just a simple thing. It's major crimes in international law. That's one part. Let's discuss the pragmatic consideration. Banning settlement goods. What does that mean? Israel, over the last couple of decades, has completely integrated its economy in the occupied Palestinian territory of Gaza and the West Bank, now the West Bank only, with Israel's economy. There is no way to separate the two economies, as Israel says. So differentiation, which is the technical term used, between Israel, per se, and the settlements is impossible. There is no way to tell if a cherry tomato is coming from Israel or from the settlements, those two entities which are one and the same. That's first. So it's impossible. Even if it were to pass, it will lead to absolutely nothing. Nothing. Zero impact on Israel. Because you cannot tell. Israel cheats, as Human Rights Watch found out many, many, many years ago. It even then, it used to mix settlement products with non-settlement products and have some address in Tel Aviv and say, oh, it's a product of Israel. So you cannot tell. The last thing is that, since when a state commits a crime, You punish the crime and not the criminal. It is only in Israel's case. We've never heard about this in history. When South Africa committed crimes in Bantustans, no one called for punishing South African presence in Bantustans. South Africa was to be punished. It's the state responsible for the crimes. Israel, even if you don't believe in that Israel is a settler colony, just you believe that Israel is committing an illegal occupation, as the ICJ has said, that per se should mean that Israel, its regime of apartheid and occupation, should be held accountable. You cannot punish the settlements and not the criminal that established and maintains the settlements. You punish the criminal, not the crime. That's basic, except in Israel's case. And this is all because of cowardice, because of intimidation and bullying from the lobby. Everyone is so terrified to say the truth, that it's the state committing the crime that should be held accountable. When it comes to Israel, no one says that because of cowardice, nothing else. And we should push for moral courage. People have to say things right under international law. It's the state that is responsible. It's the state of Israel that must be held accountable and should see some consequences.
I think most people in this tent, I was going to say room, it's certainly not that. Most people in this tent, I think, would long to see Keir Starmer come out and call it a genocide. Not Keir Starmer, Andy Burnham call it a genocide. He's unlikely to go there. What would you suggest is the minimum we should be demanding from him?
Personally, I don't see us investing all our human capacity to push Burnham to recognize genocide as such as very strategic. It is important, but it's not going to happen anytime soon. The political constellation in the UK does not allow it. The lobby is far too strong. The politicians in the UK are far too corrupt. The conservatives are far too strong. The fascists are stronger than ever. This will not allow for him to take that decision. But it's not as relevant as recognizing what the ICJ said, which the UK until now has not publicly disputed. The ICJ said Israel is plausibly committing genocide. Under the Genocide Convention, that's all we need. We don't need to prove genocide for states to assume their legal obligations. The legal obligation is triggered by the very risk of genocide. That risk is now granted by the ICJ. They said there's a plausible risk of genocide. So the UK, since 2024, since January, had the legal responsibility to act to prevent, which translates to a military embargo, a full military embargo, two-way, including dual-use items, including intelligence. That's the key responsibility in the UK, a full military embargo, ending the special association agreement, free trade agreement with Israel, including in academia. Israel is treated like royalty in British academia. That has to end. And all special treatment of Israel have to end, not because of charitable acts on behalf of the British government, not because, God forbid, they woke up and became ethical, they won't, because they have a legal duty. And if they don't comply with their legal duties, they're helping Netanyahu and Trump destroy international law. Then we're facing a might makes right world. And in a might makes right world, the British Empire is no more. It is not the strongest beast out there. Everyone suffers in a might makes right era, except the 1%. No one has an interest in a might makes right except the 1%. We all need to fight that to uphold international law, to uphold respect, hold your government accountable for your own sake, for humanity's sake, not just for Palestinians.
Thank you.
I don't understand why, when the world boycotted South Africa and the multinationals pulled out of Russia when it invaded Ukraine, why they're not taking the same line as you're advocating, you agree, in Israel. And sadly, coming down to the conclusion, there is corruption behind the scene. You mentioned briefly about our politicians being corrupt. Can you expand on that?
On the first point, as much pleasure as that may give you or anyone else to have a citizen's arrest against your prime minister, it won't help. It won't stop anything. It's the establishment. Figureheads come and go. It's the establishment. So there is no magical solution that will end British complicity. It's multifaceted. It's decades long. It must take incremental steps everywhere. Rather than one big step somewhere, we need many, many, many steps everywhere, which means every person in what I call their sphere of relative influence can push some BDS measure in their own institution, in their own city council. The cumulative effect will compel government eventually to do the right thing. In history, that's how it worked. I was an activist long time ago in the South African anti-apartheid movement when I was a student in New York at Columbia University. And again then, there was no magical wand. Nothing we could do that would end Colombia's complicity with South Africa suddenly, quickly. So the black-led movement occupied Columbia College at the time, and of course we supported them fully, to divest. But we needed a lot of work. It took years to get the community to support us. The churches and the trade unions and the black community and everyone else rallied behind the students until the Columbia trustees felt the heat and they eventually divested. So there is no shortcut. We've got to build the movement. We've got to build what we call people power. And it comes in many, many forms. Litigation power, media power, intersectional coalition building power. There's so many forms of power that we have potentially and we have to exercise to push politicians to act the right way. Only when they feel there's a massive constituency and we might lose our seats will they act. As I said, politicians are not the same. Some are ethical, some are less ethical, but they're all politicians. They're all political. They know votes. They know numbers. Let's give them numbers. One city council after another, when they divest, when they do the right thing, that sends the right message to all parties, not just to Labour. That, you know what, the UK public has shifted. Some 70%+ of the UK public today views Israel's regime of oppression unfavorably or very unfavorably. Let's translate that to political power, because that's only potential power. 3/4 of the UK are against Israel. Okay. Show me how that will affect me as a politician, and then I will open my ears and listen to you. So that's the first thing. On the second point was...
The second point was about...
Why
not boycott? Yeah.
There are many, many different reasons. Corruption is definitely one of them. There's no way to avoid that. After the Epstein affair, let no one tell you such issues don't exist. The Israeli government and Israeli private Mossad companies, as they call themselves, have been found by the French government, by the Slovenian government, by the New York City government, that they've intervened in so many elections worldwide. They call themselves private Mossad companies, very connected to the security establishment in Israel. So corruption is very real. Israel's interference in elections is more than real, very well documented. By The Guardian, by Plus972, an Israeli publication. They've documented, they've done a really good job to expose some of those intelligence/private intelligence services and what they do. So corruption is a very real thing. But it's not just corruption. It's also colonial affinity, what we call colonial hypocrisy. The UK establishment has an interest to shield Israel from accountability for many reasons, including because they don't want to be facing the same charges. What has the UK done for centuries against the humanity? From the slavery to colonialism, you name it, from Indonesia to Kenya to you name it, I mean the UK. So they don't want to open that Pandora's box, so let's keep it closed. Let's protect our own. And Israel is seen by the colonial West as our own colony. So shielding it from accountability, protects colonial interests in the West, not to mention companies that have a lot of interest in profiteering, especially US companies, not just military, but digital weapons companies. The Googles and the Amazons and the Palantirs and the Oracles and the Microsofts and Ciscos are all genocidal. They're all guilty of supporting genocide. And this brings in a lot of profits because they get to field test on us and sell their products to dictators, authoritarian regimes across the world, how to suppress dissent and human rights. So there are many, many factors. There isn't one factor. But if I were to use a hashtag, it's colonial hypocrisy.
Thank you. Hi, thank you. This was amazing. You're amazing. I was wondering if you could talk specifically about Christian Zionism and the ideas of Christian Zionism that are particularly powerful in America, but are obviously coming over to the UK as so much American culture does.
I have two questions, if I may. One is around your view on a one state versus a two state solution and where you stand on that. And where the debate about a one state got lost along the way. And the second is around, I'm an asset manager. I have an increasing ethical compliance function around me. There is a number of, they call it ESG for some reason, but it's supposed to be an ethical compliance function or a function of ethics. How are you feeding into the army of people now that is supposed to police ethical investing? And why is Palestine not a key issue when the issues of ethical investing is raised?
Hiya, what would you say to certain trade unions and organisations that have adopted defensive lines such as we need to protect the arms trade with Israel because that protects British jobs, and could you also comment on the intersectionality of the Palestinian struggle for national liberation with wider anti-imperialism here in the UK? Thank you.
Thank you. So five questions.
yeah. Okay, let's start with Christian Zionism. To put it very simply, most evangelical Christian Zionists are totally, completely supportive of Israel, no matter what it does, including through the genocide, because they believe this will accelerate the return of the Messiah. And when the Messiah returns, he will call on everyone to embrace Christ or be killed. So they want to kill all Jews and others who don't embrace Christ openly. I mean, some of their preachers, TV preachers, you know, in the US, they're very fashionable. They're very open about it. Thou shall embrace Christ or you'll be killed. And the Israeli government has no problem with this absolute, most vicious, evil form of anti-Semitism. I mean, they want to kill all Jews who don't embrace Christ when the Messiah returns. And they have no problem with that. As long as they're pro-Israel, we give you the certificate you're not anti-Semitic. So the new anti-Semitism, as defined by Israel, is opposition to Israel. Saying Israel is an apartheid state is a form of supposedly anti-Semitism. Saying Israel was established, as I said, as a settler colony that ethnically cleansed indigenous Palestinians is supposedly anti-Semitic. What does this have to do with Jews? Anti-Semitism, as many progressive liberal Jewish organizations say, is anti-Jewish hatred, bigotry, and discrimination because of being Jewish. It has nothing to do with Israel. This conflation is extremely dangerous, and that's what Zionists are doing, Christian Zionists. So they need to be fought ideologically, not just their projects need to be fought. And that's why there's liberation theology, like the Kairos movement in Palestine, which is supported by many in the UK and across the world, that are fighting the Zionist theology, because it's truly genocidal theology against Jews, not against Palestinians, against Jews in particular. It's a genocidal theology, but because it's so many other reasons. So Christian Zionism needs to be fought very vehemently. The one silver lining, even in the US, the belly of the beast, is that younger evangelical Christians are increasingly stepping away from Zionism. They no longer buy it, that we have to support a genocidal state, killing innocent people, including Christians, targeting the third oldest church in the world, a Catholic church in Gaza, and killing a priest, or injuring a priest and killing several parishioners, just because we're waiting for the Messiah to return. If all this happens, it's just they're starting to step away from this crazy fanatic ideology. So that's helpful in a way. On the asset management thing, and this is an important point, increasingly we're seeing many investors and investment firms and asset managers asking us, many of our clients want to be more ethical. And in particular, regarding Palestine, this is a very new phenomenon. Just in 2024 onwards, we've never heard such a thing before. Most investors wanted to maximize profits. Some of them were more ethical than others and said, I don't want to invest in the arms industry, the fossil fuel industry, and so on. They specified what industries they want to avoid. But Palestine was never among them. Human rights were never among those criteria that ethical investment or socially responsible, they didn't call it ethical, social responsible investment did not include those criteria. Now, increasingly, because of the genocide, there's so many people around the world, so many, millions and millions of people who do not want their money to be used in the commission of crime. And this is not just people who have a lot of money. It's every teacher and every worker and every working person who has a pension fund and wants to influence their pension fund not to be invested in crime. We're seeing a lot of those people. Now, this is a good sentiment, but as I said, you have to be strategic. Unless you organize and translate this potential power into real people power, the asset managers will not listen because their fiduciary duty is to maximize profit, right? And in the US, I don't know how it is in the UK, I suspect it's the same. The Anglo-Saxon system is pretty much the same. But in the US, fiduciary duty by law excludes extraneous factors, which means human rights. You can't say, I want to pull out investments from this company because it's committing violations of human rights. You might be held legally accountable in the US if you did that, unless you could prove that investing in a human rights violating company is bad for maximizing profits, because that's your utter duty. And of course it is. Look at South Africa. I'll just give an example. I won't mention which church, but a very, very big Protestant, very rich church in the US. I met with their pension fund managers. It's a multi-billion dollar pension fund, so massive. They met with us in Ramallah. We gave them a presentation about the occupation, apartheid, blah, 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 and they were yawning. They're asset managers, I mean. Get to the point. How does that affect anything we do? Because we have a fiduciary duty to maximize profits. And I said, well, have you learned anything from South Africa? Investing in apartheid South Africa was extremely lucrative. I mean, semi-slave labor. The South African companies and American companies and British companies were using the majority of the people there as semi-slave, under semi-slave conditions, horrible pay, no rights whatsoever. So the profits were skyrocketing. But then when the resistance to apartheid succeeded and political apartheid was dismantled, the profits went down to zero. So you've lost your entire investments. Those companies that did not pull out in time lost massively. So yes, human rights violations can be very bad for business as well. Final point I'll say about this, because this is usually not talked about. Actually, I have something written about it just to save us time. Okay, I'll just ad lib. Israel is what today we're calling it a shutdown nation. 130 top Israeli economists in May 2024 sent a letter to Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu telling him, unless we do some drastic steps, extreme steps, and they named them, Israel is entering a spiral of collapse. That's a direct quote. A spiral of collapse. And not just economic collapse, but a general collapse. And they have a six-page theory. They explained exactly how Israel is entering a spiral of collapse. And that was 2 years ago. And nothing has changed except to the worse for the Israeli economy. Brain drain galore outside of Israel, to the US mainly, but also Europe to an extent, capital, and so on. There are many, many factors. So investing in Israel today is not just unethical, it's not just as illegal, it is stupid. It is reckless from an investment perspective. Except if you're investing short-term in military companies, which are making huge profits because of the genocide. So all of this to say that we can push asset managers to be more ethical, more responsible, but also less reckless in investing in companies that are not involved in apartheid and genocide. But it's a growing community, and I suggest connecting with other groups that are doing exactly that. I'm no economic expert, but there's so many who are and are doing very similar work. Your second question,
I think we're running quite late on time, so I think if we went to the trade union one about trade unions whose members are involved in companies making weapons, etc.
Sure. The argument that we should continue selling weapons to a state committing genocide, apartheid, and all sorts of crimes because it's good for our workers is beyond unethical. Beyond. I mean, it's just your job is more important than my life, than my child's life. How dare you? How dare you tell me that your job is more important than my child's life? Enough with this hypocrisy and unethical behavior. And guess what? Your job is not dependent on continuing to kill our people and exterminate them, in fact. It's a myth. This government and all the previous governments, Thatcher onwards and possibly before, the austerity measures, the privatization, the selling off of everything public, everything they're doing, the destruction of the social welfare system in the UK, this is not responsible for your misery, and we are? So what I've always said to trade unions, you've got to see the right enemy. The enemy is this austerity government, the right-wing government, whether they call themselves Labour or not, they're all right-wing governments. And they're pushing money away from social security, away from health, education, and services, away from climate protection, to bigger and bigger military companies, securitization. And now this Labour government wants to invest even more in militarization, hyper-militarization. Who will pay for all those American weapons? And they will be mostly American weapons. Your tax money, your social services. That's what you need to fight, not our divestment campaigns to stop helping Israel commit genocide against us.
Thank you so much. Omar, thank you so much for today. It's been absolutely fantastic and a real privilege to have you here.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.